the weapons designers, as part of the process of designing new things in weapons, would take them out to site 300, and you put depleted uranium in some of the tests instead of plutonium, and you can blow it up full scale and you can take pictures of the implosion. But that puts a lot of debris into the air, into the soil, and ultimately into some of the springs and into the groundwater. And that's why in 1990, site 300 was put on the EPA's Superfund list, or as Scott explained, the national priorities list of most contaminated sites in the nation. The cleanup is slated to take, right now it's slated to take forever, in that the Department of Energy has no date certain when cleanup will be done. But they have kind of a ballpark estimate of how much they think it's going to cost, which is $1.8 billion. But I don't think that's a very solid estimate because you don't know how long it's going to take. You don't really know how much it's going to cost. The cleanup right now is like $300. It's about $11 million a year, which is only about 1% of Livermore Labs' Department of Energy budget. So one of Tri Valley Care's contentions is that more than 1% of the budget should be for cleanup. That's a priority to our community. To talk a little bit about the history as well, as Bob mentioned, there are unlined dump sites at Site 300. What they did was they took earth moving equipment and went out and dug big trenches to put the waste in. There's waste from the firing cables in there, but there's also some waste they trucked from the Livermore Lab main site and dumped here in Tracy at Site 300. And they went to a low-lying area because, you know, it's hilly there where it was flat and you could dig the big trenches that are like these rooms. And this really blows me away because he's a PhD. But the low-lying area, when you dug into it, in the wet years, the groundwater rises and the groundwater mixed directly in those unlined trenches with the waste. And then when it got dry again, the groundwater goes back down and it just carries the contamination. There's one place at Site 300 up here where you see Pit 7 complex, which you can see here is the foot, and so we're talking about up here. That's where a lot of the trenches are. And under going down from the pit and under building 850, which is one of those open air firing cables, there's about a 2-mile-long plume that has depleted uranium, it has tritium, the radioactive hydrogen of the hydrogen bomb. And to recall what Bob said, uranium-238 has a long half-life, about 4.5 billion years. And tritium is a little more than 12 years in terms of its half-life. And so these materials are in the soil, in the bedrock, in the groundwater, and still slowly moving. We're in a dialogue all the time with them about the importance of clean control and how to keep moving. There is one place in what's called the general services area where there's a lot of volatile organics. Just to give you a very short list of what some of these contaminants are. So there's a lot of volatile organic compounds. These are solvents, things like PCE. They use it as heat exchange fluid, as degreaser. There's a big plume. There's a bunch of this stuff all over the place. And from this general services area, there's actually an off-site plant that goes under Corral Hollow and under Corral Hollow Creek that's in the process of being pulled back and remediated. There are also high explosive compounds all over the site in various places. There's perchlorate, which is used in high explosives, nitrate, tritium that we mentioned, the radioactive hydrogen, depleted uranium, PCBs, dioxins, furans, and a number of metals and something called PFOS. These things are all toxic. Many of them are carcinogenic. There's a lot of health problems that are associated with exposure to anyone, let alone the smorgasbord of the contaminants. So it's very important that the cleanup be done thoroughly, that it be done completely, that it be done right, and that it be done in a timely manner, not that it be left. I want to be short, but I want to say a few words about community action and how important it is. You heard from Bob about how he got involved in stopping the permit that would have allowed them to increase the size of the class that open air at like 300. And one of the things that happened because of his intervention and Tri-Valley Care's help in that intervention was the San Joaquin District asked the laboratory for more information. The lab's first pyramid application didn't have the various constituents that would be in the explosion, as Bob explained. So the second application did. And it turned out there were about 60 different hazardous and radioactive materials that would be in those explosions. And then they would be on 4 firing tables, which are kind of here. And 850, 851, 845, and 812. You're going to hear a lot about 812 from Peter because there are some very important decision points coming up in that cleanup. The reason that 812 is part of the Superfund cleanup now is because they didn't get the permit and it got closed. That's a huge victory for the community. In fact, 3 out of 4 of these are not used for programmatic explosions. 2 are closed completely, 850 and 812. 1 is used to detonate high explosive waste, 845, and 851 is the last open air firing table that's still used today. So there is still pollution coming from Site 300 in terms of airborne and free glass, but not as much as it would have been. And so I really want you to understand that community action makes a huge difference. Also, Bob briefly mentioned a biosafety level 4, which are the kinds of bio labs where they have to wear moon suits because BSL-4s look at biotoxins and bioagents for which there's no known cure. And the reason that the Department of Homeland Security did not put it at Site 300, according to their documents, was no community acceptance. So a community being active and speaking out really does a lot in terms of maintaining and supporting the health of the community and the health of the environment. There are a couple of things that I want to call your attention to that we're doing, and we'll talk about it more after we're done with the presentation. But right now we have a petition. It's for both the main site Superfund cleanup and the Site 300 Superfund cleanup. And please read it over. There's an 8 extras that are off on the table. There's the English and here's the Spanish. And they're basically to the Department of Energy and Congress asking for the adequate, stable, long-term funding that's needed over the years and over the decades if a real cleanup, an adequate cleanup, is going to take place. And so getting these into the schools, getting these into the Spanish language masses, getting these out into the community can do a lot. And we're going to be taking them to Washington, D.C., to talk to Congress with them on March 17th, and then after that we'll use them in other meetings. But if you can get them in before March 17th, we'll bring them to Washington. I want to just do a little introduction to Building 812, which I actually had to put it in on this map. Because remember, Building 812, at the time the lab did this map of cleanup sites, was still an active firing table. So they weren't going to clean it up. But it's right here on the map, by 814 over from 845 and a little down from 801. Tri-Valley Paris did a site tour of Site 300 not too long ago. We went to this area, and it's steep. Peter's going to talk a little more about it. So it's not going to be easy to clean up. but it can be cleaned up. And in their own proposed plan for the overall, say, 300 Superfund cleanup, they talk about the fact that it's difficult to remove dirt from the fire vehicles, but that it can be done, it can be done successfully. And so, in the decision-making process, the community's voice to say, yes, we want this done right, is going to be very important. And I have some questions for you during the question and answer period when you have questions for us, when it's some things for you to think about. But I'm going to save those and right now just sort of introduce our environmental scientist and technical advisor, Peter Strauss. Thank you.
I see a lot of new faces in the audience. How many people are familiar with the Superfund, just the term Superfund, just the way that it is? How many people are familiar with the term feasibility study? Okay, that gives me a sort of Okay, so imagine a firing table that is opening, is exploding depleted uranium. It's in the face of a canyon, and it explodes it out and disperses all this stuff around this canyon on the soil. It's also in the right in the ground, seeps into the ground and the ground. There are two places, there are two streams. One is the Elk Ravine, which is a continuous stream, flowing stream, and then there's one that's ephemeric stream. That's not continuous all year round. So imagine that scenario where you explode this stuff and leave. And now I'm going to give you a little history about why this particular site is important. In 2005, the Department of Energy started to do the characterization of the site, defining what's there. And they came up with a remedial investigation, which is a complicated characterization of the site. And combine that with what's called a feasibility study. The feasibility study is an evaluation of all the alternatives, all the solutions for getting rid of the materials that can have treated. So in 2008, they discussed this with the EPA and the regulators. We had some comments, but this was not the thing that was right on our radar. And the DOE had proposed to do some soil action, where they would separate out. They would scrape off some of the hillside. They would separate out the contaminated soil from the clean soil, and then they would dispose of that. EPA had problems with that, and thought that for uranium, it would not quite work. So the lab then said, okay, and DOE appointed a team that was made up of Savannah River people from all over the United States. to do an assessment of what Livermore had done. And they said, you know, we think we should reevaluate the whole scenario. You should do another characterization. You should do another risk assessment, and then come to a conclusion about what should be done. And so, just imagine that's when we, our radar, got we elevated this site, because we thought that. And there were some suggestions that they would minimize some of the health cleanup standards that were being used, and ecological cleanup standards that were being used for this site, and reduce those standards. So we wanted to watch this very, very carefully. So without getting too much detail, but a little bit of technical detail, which I think I have to do. The first step in the process was a screening level risk assessment, and that uses all the known cleanup standards, the strictest cleanup standards, to identify contaminants of concern. Really, what you want to do is to define and identify the contaminants of concern, and then you can come up with a feasibility study to solve the problem. That was done, and. They, because of their steep canyons, they had to use robotics, really androids, to climb these steep canyons and do gamma testing to define where the radioactivity is. It's an ecologically very rich area. There are springs there. There are species of very high concern to the state of California. Some of them are endangered that live in that area. And so you want to make sure that we not only talking about human health, we're talking about the birds and bees. So to get to the point of why we were concerned, I mean, this is the. I'm going to jump ahead in why I am particularly concerned about this site is that, and I'm going to pose these as questions. In the characterization, are we missing anything, especially concerning ecological receptors? Are we missing some of the surface water and sediment contaminants? Right now, I think they are. Have we delineated the area sufficiently? In risk assessments, are we going to eliminate significant contaminants through risk assessment? Now, the screen level risk assessment, they use the strictest standards, and then the risk assessment goes down and narrows it down and says, well, let's do a risk assessment. And some people don't know what that means, and it's a probability, a lot of assumptions, a lot of modeling, so it has to be really carefully done. So I am very concerned that some contaminants are going to be screened out, and they're not going to be looked at in the future. That's right. It's not clear to me how groundwater and sediments will be characterized, and eventually how they will be remediated or cleaned up. And then we have cleanup standards. Do we have enough knowledge to identify standards for eco-receptors? Is the assumption about industrial use sufficient in the long term? Now, I fail to tell you this, that they assume, for risk assessment purposes, that there will be an outdoor industrial worker. We're not talking about what Bob talks about a resident we're talking about. So the exposure is less for an industrial outdoor worker than somebody who's living there all the time. If you're a farmer living there and you're growing crops, your cleanup standard is going to be way different than an industrial outdoor worker. So that's a very big concern. And getting it right now is important. And finally, I'm not sure that they have funding that they have allocated. The last time I heard, they have not allocated funding to complete this process, which involves, after the characterization and the risk assessment, coming up with a remedial investigation and a new feasibility study and proposing a plan. And that's what they that's the path that they have. And I think I've probably bombarded you with enough jargon and technical information that if you have questions, then I'll take it.
So before we go on, I just want to add something that's kind of anecdotal evidence of the contamination out there, and that is that at Tri-Valley here, we have a sick worker support group that we facilitate, and it's a group made up of mainly former employees of Livermore Lab and Site 300 who have been made ill by on-the-job exposure there. And I've worked with several employees who worked at Site 300 recently, doing things like digging ditches and building roads and getting in the dirt, and they have been made ill, and believe they've been made seriously ill in many circumstances from exposure to contamination that they received on the job. So it's somewhat circumstantial, but I think that it's another aspect of the problem that is worth thinking about. And also, I'm curious about what you guys think and who you are. So raise your hand if you've never heard about Site 300 before you heard about this community meeting. Keep them up, I'd like to see. Yeah, so quite a few of you. And raise your hand, too, if you've never heard of it and you live in Tracy. Of Site 300. So that's quite a few of you. And I venture to say that that's on purpose. They don't want people to ask questions about Site 300, and at this point, of course, its establishment there predates many of us, especially in this room. So that's why it's important for us to have community meetings like this, and it's been a while since we had a community meeting, but this is a great turnout, and how many of you would be interested if we had annual community meetings here? All right, I'm glad to see that. And the lab doesn't make an effort to have any more community outreach than it's absolutely required to by the law. So there are certain points in the Superfund cleanup that they are required to have a community meetings and to reach out to the community. The next one is in September of 2015. So one thing that we can talk about today is asking for the lab to do a, and asking for a Site 300 to have a meeting before that, to have a meeting every year. We could do a pre-meeting if people were interested and able to go to both. So we should talk about that. So in thinking of those things, I'd also just like to see if any of you have questions about those topics or for any of the specific speakers. Yes?
Does Littlemore get more attention than Tracy because Site 300 comes under the Littlemore Association rather than Tracy? But Lindlow's, we get the effect of not the attention.
I'll let Mary Jane answer that.
In terms of the Superfund cleanup of soil and groundwater, I wish I could tell you that that were true. When it comes to programmatic work, in fact, nuclear weapons activities is make up 88% of Livermore Lab's annual budget. But in terms of the cleanup at the Livermore Lab main site, it's about 1% of the lab's budget every year. In the cleanup at Site 300, it's about 1% also. And in fact, Site 300 gets ever so slightly more than the main last few years. So it's more a matter of the inequality of attention between weapons activities and cleanup, not so much inequality of attention between the main site and Site 300.
Is there any more? They also have an energy meeting in 2015, or they have heard of it?
Let me say a couple words about, that's a very good question, a couple words about the Superfund law. One of the really good things about the Superfund law is that it mandates that the responsible parties, the polluter, in this case Livermore Lab, will have the public meeting at specific times. The main time is when there's something called a proposed plan. So that happened in Livermore earlier, and there had not been actual public meetings in Livermore about the main site. However, because there was public interest, there is an unofficial information sharing meeting about once a year. At Site 300, so far, the layout has only done the public meetings that are required by the Superfund law, and a couple of other times we have gotten to do our public work law. I just want to sort of show you this. I tried out with Harris Stanley and with the technical staff at the laboratory with Peter and myself about once every 3 months, and this is from the last time, so I want to just kind of let you visualize it. So this process of doing the site characterization and doing the risk, you know, the screening level risk assessment that leads to a risk assessment that leads to the remedial investigation feasibility study, the proposed plan, and the public meeting. These are the little boxes along the way of what leads to what. And then the public meeting happens in the spring of 2015, September 2015, I'm sorry, not the spring. And so what our thought was, if there's interest in the community, and this is really what we're here to ask you, should you guys yourselves and Tri-Valley Cares ask the laboratory, should you maybe an annual meeting, just once a year, have an unofficial workshop? Because the Superfund law says when you have to have a meeting. It doesn't say you can't have a meeting unless you have to have it. So the lab could have unofficial workshops, you know, something less formal, where they just give you an update on the progress. And then we would be very happy to do either a pre-meeting or a post-meeting to make, you know, a place where questions can be asked, where or other, you know, materials and things could be distributed that would also be once a year.